Counting down to Jupiter, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure in our solar system and beyond. And yes, that's the first time we've opened with that line. Another mission leader joins us this week as he prepares for the arrival of his spacecraft at the King of Planets. We'll talk with Principal Investigator Scott Bolton about Juno and Jupiter. Bill Nye prepares us for that conversation as only the science guy can. Senior Editor Emily Lakdawalla gets us rolling with her report about a mission to one of the nearest yet most mysterious locations in our solar neighborhood. Emily, you've now written about this next mission that China is planning to land on the moon and rove around a little bit. Tell us about it.
Well, we're talking about Chang'e 4, which is based on the backup spacecraft of the mission that became Chang'e 3. They've done this with their previous missions. Basically, they build two spacecraft, they launch one, and if the first one achieves its goals, which both Chang'e 1 and Chang'e 3 did, then they launch the backup one as a slightly more ambitious mission, and that's what's happening with Chang'e 4.
Is this one going to that mysterious, still somewhat mysterious, side of the moon that we can't see?
Yes, this one is going to be the world's very first far-side lunar lander, which is pretty amazing. And in order to make that work, of course, because the moon keeps that side of it facing away from Earth at all times, there isn't an easy way to communicate with the spacecraft that's back there. So they're actually going to have to launch an orbiter mission, a mission that will journey to the Earth-Moon L2 point, kind of this gravitational balance point along the far side of the moon, to serve as a communications relay. And then 6 months later, they're going to launch the Chang'e 4 lander and rover.
Making this mission even more interesting. All right, what is it about the far side, other than that we can't see it from down here, that makes it so special?
Well, there's two main reasons to put a mission there. One is the one that the Chinese seem to be pursuing, which is the fact that you can use the great bulk of the moon, which is planet-sized and planet-shaped, to shield your spacecraft from the radio emissions of Earth. So they're going to be doing some radio astronomy back there on the far side of the moon. The other reason is that the far side has this feature called the South Pole Aitken Basin. It's the largest impact basin on the moon, stretching from the South Pole in the south to the Aitken Crater, which is a bit below the equator. If you look at the far side of the moon, it's got this different color to it. It's clearly there's different mineralogy there. It's the oldest impact feature on the moon. It's probably the deepest. They think it may have even dredged up mantle material. So being able to study its chemistry would really tell you a lot about the early history of the moon and the Earth.
Yeah, but is this spacecraft going to be able to do the chemistry work that a lot of scientists would like to see?
That's the thing I'm not so sure about. So the spacecraft has quite an ambitious complement of instruments, but one of the things that's not on this mission is any kind of instrument that can do elemental chemistry. They do have something that can do near-infrared spectroscopy, which is sort of one part of being able to identify minerals. But it's really hard to be sure what minerals you're looking at without some information about the elements present. They took off the APXS, the Alpha Particle X-ray Spectrometer, because Chang'e 4's rover will have no arm. And so that makes it kind of questionable whether they're going to be able to get the geochemistry results that people really want to see, that geologists really want to see from the far side of the moon.
All right, still some exciting plans, Emily. To the moon. Thanks so much. Shishé.
Shishé, Matt.
She is Emily Lakdawalla, our senior editor and the planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Up next is the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy. Bill, as you know, we're going to be talking to the head of the Juno mission, Scott Bolton, in just moments. I know from talking to you that you're excited about this mission, too.
Oh, man, I was really invested in this mission years ago. I went to the launch. Now it's finally going to go around Jupiter. I mean, understand, everybody, there's some cool things about the spacecraft. First of all, it got a slingshot from our own Earth. The orbit was so carefully figured out. It's all solar powered. There's no plutonium, none of the controversy that's often associated with trying to get a piece of plutonium on a rocket. It's going to do this amazing thing to try to understand if the core of Jupiter could somehow be made of hydrogen so compact. How compact would it be? It'd be so compact, it would act like a metal. The electrons would move between atoms so easily. And this would inform us a little more about physics, about chemistry, about the cosmos, because most of the cosmos is hydrogen. And so if it behaves in this new, unexpected, or heretofore unexpected way, It would, as I so often say, Matt, change the physics.
Which amounts to the world, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a cool mission. And it's another thing, everybody, very reasonably priced. You know, I did those videos for it a few years ago. It's very cool.
Scott Bolton and I talk about those during the conversation and how much we both enjoy them.
You like the red spot, I heard.
That was my favorite, number four.
So it's classic. It's just me with the physical models, with the props, being a hilarious science guy.
I got to ask, did you build that model of the red spot with the bands above and below it?
Probably.
Yeah. It looked like one of yours. It looked like
and,
your handiwork.
And hot melt glued the balsa wood. Yeah, all that stuff.
There you go. There you go. It's all, well, this stuff is not at planetary.org. It's on the Juno website. It's the Why with Nye series. There's a bunch of other good resources there. But of course, we hope you'll take a look at the planetary.org site in our ongoing coverage. Emily Lochte-Wallace, she'll be there for orbital insertion at JPL.
I'll be there too, Matt. At least they invited me. I presume I'll show up. They won't kick me out. But it's you guys, it's an exciting thing. This really is rocket science. You know, we were talking about this at this Politicon last weekend about the politics of Mars, which is closely related. But there's no business case for exploring the core of Jupiter. You don't really sell tickets to that. It is a society that's thinks it's a worthy thing to use our intellect and treasure to explore this other world, to learn more about the cosmos and our place within it. It's a fantastic mission.
It's ennobling.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much. And I look forward to talking to you next time. And I hope I'll see you there on the 4th of July.
On the 4th of Independence Day, we're going in orbit around Jupiter. Carry on.
He's Bill Nye, the CEO of the Planetary Society, and as you heard, he will be there as Juno goes into orbit. Let's talk to the leader of that mission, Scott Bolton. As I speak, only one spacecraft has ever traveled across the solar system to orbit and study Jupiter. That was Galileo, a mission that ended almost 13 years ago. It's quite possible that by the time some of you hear this, a second emissary from Earth will have been captured by Jupiter's mighty gravitational field. Scott Bolton is principal investigator for the Juno mission, which departed our planet in August of 2011. With just a handful of days left before orbital insertion and with worldwide excitement building, Scott welcomed me to the Jet Propulsion Lab near Pasadena for a conversation about Juno and how the science it seeks may unlock secrets about the origin of our and other solar systems, and much, much more. Scott spent 24 years at JPL working on a variety of missions and projects. Now this space physicist directs the SWRI, or Southwest Research Institute's Space Science and Engineering Division. Not surprisingly, his research focuses on the formation and origin of, yes, the giant planets in our and other solar systems. You spent a lot of years here. Is it good to be back, especially with what's coming up?
Yeah, it's great to be back. I mean, you know, I was here for a really long time, and I just have a lot of friends here. And so it's so great to be part of Juno and be part of the JPL team that's making that happen, and to come back and see my friends, and they all, you know, are helping to celebrate that we're finally arriving. It's great.
You've been on the show in the past. We've talked about this years before this great occasion. I have to ask the typical media question. How does it feel to be really now hours away from this huge event?
Yeah, you know, you're the only one that's ever asked that. How do I feel is a great question, because I feel really excited that we're finally arriving. And I've got to combat that with the anxiety and tension of knowing how important the orbit insertion event really is. And so I have this mixed set of emotions, this excitement and anticipation that we're finally getting there and we're going to start this cool investigation, and knowing that, oh my gosh, we've got to get this orbit burn go just right or we fly right past the planet and I have no mission. I haven't felt that kind of a mixture of excitement and anxiety since the launch, where I was really excited we were finally launching, but I was also worried, oh my God, what happens if the launch vehicle blows up? You know, so that was the largest risk of the mission. And I think this orbit insertion is the second biggest risk.
Still, though, it's going to be nerve-wracking, I'm sure. I mean, I was talking to my colleague, Emily Lakdawala, last week on the show about what's coming. And I mentioned that, you know, the 7 minutes of terror as Curiosity came down to Mars. You're giving people five times that during this rocket burn.
That's right. It's 35 minutes of wringing your hands and squeezing the chair really hard. And at 35 minutes, it gets tough. Your hand gets tired.
Because there's not much else you can do, right?
There's not much we can do. I mean, it's all in the hands of the great engineers that program the spacecraft. But it's a smart robot, but it only does what you tell it. Travel of the light time back and forth between Jupiter and Earth is 40 minutes. Our burn is 35. So by the time we know there's a problem, it's too late to do anything.
Emily told us, though, that even if the burn cuts off after 20, you won't be in the right orbit, but you'll be orbiting.
That's right. So that's a little known secret, is that while I'm sitting there, everybody is waiting for the 35 minutes and the rocket to go turn off, and then you're in orbit. But when the clock hits 20 minutes, that's when my relief happens, my first relief, because I know now we're in orbit. It may not be the best orbit, but we can do great science from that orbit. But there's another piece that will keep you tense when you're waiting for this. One is the 20 minutes, and then we're in orbit. It's better if you go 35 because they're in a better orbit. But after the rocket is done burning, we must turn the spacecraft back to sun point before the batteries drain out. We have to get power positive. To do the burn, we've moved the solar arrays away from the sun in order to fire the rocket in the right direction. That's the second piece of the tension, is I'm not totally relaxed until the engine's turned off, we're in orbit, and we're back sun pointed.
And of course, this is a challenge that no other spacecraft that has been out this far has faced, because they didn't have those big solar wings.
That's correct. Every other spacecraft that's gone into orbit, it's Jupiter or Saturn, maybe like Galileo and Cassini, they were nuclear powered. So they had to do all the burn just right, but they didn't have to worry about turning back in time to save the mission, and we will have to do that.
The solar system offers some pretty nasty environments, Venus, Io. The space that you're going to be flying through has got to be high on that list.
Yeah, it's at the top of the list. There's no question, very close to Jupiter is the single worst planetary environment in the entire solar system.
Wow.
It's because Jupiter is extreme, right? I mean, Jupiter is a planet on steroids. Everything about it is extreme, and the most extreme. So it has the single worst radiation belts of any planet. It has the strongest magnetic field, the strongest gravity field. It's spinning the fastest. I mean, they don't call it the king of the planets for nothing.
And it's a beautiful world. What do you hope we're going to learn about it from Juno?
So Juno's science, you know, really addresses quite a few different kinds of objectives. The primary and maybe most important objective has to do with the origin of Jupiter. How was it built? How was it made? What formed it? What happened in the early solar system that allowed Jupiter to form a little bit different than the sun? We create a star, and then somehow from the leftovers, we make the planets. And Jupiter's the first planet. It's got most of the leftovers. Mm-hmm. I can take everything else and it goes inside Jupiter, right? All the other planets, asteroids, comets, everything don't add up to Jupiter. So it took most of the material. So that it's that first step between the transition of making a star and making the solar system. I mean, we're really after the recipe for the solar system. How do you make them? How do you make our solar system? How do you make the other ones that are out there that we're discovering around other stars? And Jupiter kind of holds that first key secret for us. And what we're doing is investigating its interior structure, whether there's a core of heavy elements in the middle of it. What's the water abundance? How much oxygen is inside Jupiter? What are the deep dynamics? What's going on in the deep atmosphere? How deep are the zones and belts go? What's the roots to the Great Red Spot? How is it structured inside? What makes the magnetic field? And finally, how does the polar magnetosphere work? These are the most powerful auroral emissions in the entire solar system. So we, across the board, are investigating all of those kinds of objectives at the same time.
Scott Bolton is principal investigator for the Juno mission, arriving in Jupiter orbit on July 4th. He has much more to tell us after the break, and there's even more from Scott in the online version of this week's show. Planetary Radio returns in a minute.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer, and what all the other candidates think, at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, still visiting with Juno mission principal investigator Scott Bolton in the cafeteria at the Jet Propulsion Lab. It's at JPL on the 4th of July that Scott will lead an anxious team and world as the spacecraft attempts to enter orbit at Jupiter.
Give us the thumbnail description of the instrument suite that is on board that's going to deliver all this data.
We're trying to measure the invisible force fields around Jupiter. That's how you get to the interior. So we look at the gravity field. We measure the magnetic field with magnetometers. The gravity field is investigated using Doppler through the communication system. So we're watching the orbit change as we fly by. We're measuring the internal magnetic field with our magnetometers. We have microwave radiometers. Those are like radio antennas that work in the microwave regime. We have six of them. They basically see through the clouds for us. They can tell how much water is in Jupiter. They can see how deep the zones and belts go. We also have a full suite of instruments to look at the polar magnetosphere. We have infrared and UV spectrometers and imagers, high energy particle detectors, low energy particle detectors, and plasma and radio wave. And then finally, we have a visible camera called JunoCam.
Let's talk about that, because as I told you before we got started, Candy Hansen on your team, who's in charge of JunoCam, was on the show just 2 weeks ago talking about that camera. You provided a lot of stuff for other folks to do, and I have to bring up here the work by my boss, the science guy. It's this Why with Nye series, part of the education and public outreach arm of this mission, which you also oversee in addition to everything else that's going on.
Yeah, Bill Nye's great. And luckily, I happen to know him. And so when we were trying to think of things we could do to help bring in the public, and we want to be able to bring in all ages, right, all different types of people, you want to have something for everybody. Bill, of course, has an incredible following, great sense of humor. And I just called him up one day, and I said, how about doing something with us? And he goes, what do you have in mind? And I described it, and he goes, okay, that sounds great. And he made a series of videos with us that were fantastic.
Back to the poles for a moment. You compared it to what Cassini revealed there, and I assume you're talking about those incredibly strange hexagons. Do you expect surprises like that when we see the top and bottom of Jupiter for the first time?
Well, I'm reluctant to say I expect it to be a hexagon, but I certainly expect surprises. I mean, that's part of the reason you go out and explore, is you don't really know. If I knew what we were going to measure completely, it wouldn't be so exciting. So I expect we're going to see things that we don't understand, we didn't expect. And the poles of Jupiter, I actually have no idea what to expect. And so no matter what I see, it's going to be unexpected. I suppose if it looks exactly like Saturn's and there's a hexagon there, I would be surprised at that even.
In less than a week, this will be a madhouse because it'll be the center of media attention, at least the center of science media attention, as everybody joins you grabbing on to the, you know, the arms of the chair, hoping those rockets fire as they're supposed to. How soon after that will the science start to come back?
5 days prior to July 4th, we'll turn off all the science instruments because we need the spacecraft to be focused on the engineering activity we need to do. So we don't want any, even the spacecraft, to be distracted. So the science instruments go off 5 days, and then right after JOI, they go back on. And so we'll start getting some data. But the first orbit is 53 days long. So we don't come close to Jupiter until the end of August. And that will be the first time that we fly by Jupiter with all of Juno's eyes and ears open. And we'll see for the first time all of these key new discoveries that Jupiter's holding for us. I think the first science will be, it'll come down right after the end of August. So by the first week of September, we will have our first glimpse. We won't have all the answers yet, but we'll certainly get data that is surprising and fantastic.
You ever read the book 2010, by the sequel to 2001 by Arthur C. Clarke?
Absolutely.
And the movie, of course, as well. And Dave Bowman, right out there where you guys are going to be flying around delivering science, said something wonderful is going to happen. Well, I think something wonderful is going to happen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's going to be wonderful to get so close to this giant planet and learn so much about not only Jupiter's history, but our whole solar system's history. We're really going to learn about our interaction with nature, how it all works. What is the first step when you go to make the planets? What's some of our own history? Jupiter is made of almost the same thing as the Sun. It's almost all hydrogen helium. But we've learned from previous missions that it's enriched in what we call heavy elements, the carbon, the nitrogen, the sulfur. We don't actually know why or how that happened. But we know it's important because the stuff that Jupiter has more of is what we're all made out of. And so it comes back to us. Jupiter represents that first step that must have taken place very early in the solar system, where the Sun forms and already the planets are getting their endowment of these heavy elements. They're getting enriched. And we don't know how that happens, but we know that it's important because whatever the reason for that happening, it's responsible for our existence.
Thank you, Scott. And best of luck on the 4th of July and in the months to follow as Juno reveals this glorious planet.
Thank you. And thank you and all of your audience for sharing this journey with us.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. He is on the Skype line. What's up?
All right, we got our three friends in the evening skies still. We've got Jupiter over in the west, brightest star-like object over there in the early evening. And as you move towards south and east, you will see Mars, which a little tidbit about Mars, it is now merely as bright as the brightest star in the sky, dimmer than Jupiter. It's about Sirius brightness. Will continue to dim, so check it out because it's still bright, pretty reddish. And then Saturn is not too far away from it, much dimmer and yellowish. We move on to this week in space history. 1971, we honor the death of the Soyuz 11 crew who died during reentry. And then in 1908, the Tunguska impact is a roughly 30-meter asteroid or comet object exploded high over Tunguska, Siberia, leveling 2,000 square kilometers of forest. So we use that as a reminder that asteroid defense, it's important.
Happy Asteroid Day to all.
Happy Asteroid Day. I don't know what the right right presentation of that is, but yes, acknowledging Asteroid Day and the importance of planetary defense. We move on to Random Space.
And I got a good one for you next week. Just wait.
Oh, I can hardly wait. The center density of the Sun is more than 12 times the center density of Earth. But the average density of the Sun is only about 25% the average density of Earth, because it gets all light and fluffy towards the outside. Chewy on the inside. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. And I ask you, what was the first human space flight of the Chinese space program? How'd we do?
A very big response this time around, bigger than usual. Chosen by random.org was, full disclosure here, Craig Gernay in Los Alamitos, California. Been about 2 years since Craig has won the contest, but he hung in there. It really was just chosen by random.org in spite of the fact that I used to work with this guy, and that's why I happen to know that he used to work on the Deep Space Network out at Goldstone. So interesting guy. His answer was that first human spaceflight by the Chinese, Shenzhou 5.
That is correct.
Then, Craig, you have won yourself a new Planetary Radio t-shirt. We might have had the old style the last time he won. A genuine Planetary Society rubber asteroid and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account for the worldwide network of telescopes operated by those good folks at iTelescope. So have fun with that. John Kurtz in Naperville, Illinois, said that loves space science and spent a lot of time in China, so he's a good person to explain this to us. Shenzhou roughly means boat of the gods or vessel of the gods. Shen meaning god and Zhu meaning boat. He was also one of many people who said that space capsule was piloted by Yang Liwei. And Dave Fairchild chimed in. Russia and NASA had been the first two to orbit a human in space, and then the Chinese said, hello, if you please, we'll add Shenzhou 5 to the race. Thank you, Dave.
We move on. Matt, I know you like to hang out on the surface of the sun.
I go at night.
Brilliant, brilliant. If Matt or anyone is on the surface of the sun, moments before they vaporize, and by surface of the sun, we're going to define that as it's usually defined as the edge of the photosphere, so the visible surface. What do we see at visible wavelengths? What is the ratio of the equatorial surface gravity of the sun at its surface compared to that of Earth approximately? In other words, how much more pull downwards are you going to get? So how much are you going to be pulled downwards while you're being vaporized? Did that make sense, Matt?
Absolutely. I love that. That's a great question.
All right. You can give it in terms of Earth. So it's ratio. So give it in terms of Earth's surface gravity. 1G often is the terminology. Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
You got until July 5th, Tuesday, July 5 at 8 a.m. Pacific time, and you'll get that same prize package, a Planetary Radio t-shirt, a rubber asteroid, and a 200-point iTelescope.net account. We are done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky. Think about bumper stickers and where have they gone? Thank you, and good night.
I wonder if Shenzhou 5 had a bumper sticker. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Asteroid Day is or was June 30th. I promised you last week that we'd be marking it with yet another special segment. That segment is waiting for you at planetary.org/radio, as well as iTunes, SoundCloud, and many other online sources. It's a fascinating conversation with UCLA grad student Adam Greenberg. Adam talked with me from the giant radio telescope at Arecibo, Puerto Rico, where he was using that great dish's million-watt radar beam to explore a near-Earth asteroid. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its jovial members. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.